Welcome to Crossing the Divide, part of a grassroots, multimedia collaboration between Rocky Mountain PBS, Mesa County Libraries, and the Daily Sentinel. The Crossing the Divide project creates a forum for Western Slope voices to educate the community on local matters. Crossing the Divide portrays the unique realities of life in the region and provides a tool for rebuilding a sense of trust and common purpose that enables citizens to transcend divides and work together to overcome the challenges we face. I'm Gretchen Reist, your guide over the divide and into the diverse terrain of Western Colorado. This podcast is the first piece of what I hope to expand into a multimedia project focused on life in the Intermountain West. My guest for this edition of Crossing the Divide, the official podcast, is Grand Junction author Heather Portenier. Heather is a freelance writer and editor whose work has appeared in various newspapers, magazines, and literary anthologies. Her first book, Please Excuse the Mess, is a memoir about her son's recovery from a traumatic brain injury and the many tragedies that followed over a six-year span. In 2017, she released her first novella in a romance collection titled Flat Tire. And just last month, she released the second book in her quickie romance collection titled The Dandelion Hunter. Today's discussion is inspired by PBS's The Great American Read, an eight-part series that examines the power of reading through the prism of 100 best-loved novels based on a national survey. This series will conclude in October of this year, when the final votes are tallied to reveal which of those 100 books is chosen by viewers as America's most beloved novel. Heather, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we delve into your life as an author, because we are tying this into PBS's The Great American Read, I'd like to focus on you as a reader.
Okay.
So take us back to your youth. Were you always an avid reader as a kid?
Oh, very much so. I started out pretty young. I always did the summer reading programs. We were from a small town, so there wasn't a lot to do as far as our parents entertaining us, so we were at the library all the time. And I took that love for reading and fell in love with writing, too, from a young age. I wanted to be a writer since I was 8, just because of my love of reading. And that continued all through my life. I'm a pretty fast reader, too. So I would just blow through books. My mom would be kind of frustrated sometimes because she'd be like, "We have to go back to the library." And I loved reading everything. Just using your imagination was so satisfying. You live in a small town, like I said, and there's not a lot to do. So, and you're a kid using your imagination, and reading was something so different than playing. So,
were your parents avid readers? I mean,
neither one.
No.
Both of my sisters read, but neither my mom or dad were avid readers.
Yeah, I don't remember my parents reading much either. And I think as I got older, I think there was always a sense of guilt around reading for me, actually, that somehow it just wasn't productive time.
Oh, well, it helped me in school, too, being able to read like that. I never struggled with reading, which is very... My husband struggled with reading all through school. My son struggled with reading. But we always read when he was growing up. So I took that love. Of course, I was a writer, too. And he always loved to read. It was just difficult for him.
Were there any books that you were particularly attracted to as a kid? Any genres or?
Oh, I started with probably Babysitter's Club kind of things and then moved on to Sweet Valley High as I got older. I always loved the romance, the relationships, the that human connection. And then as I got older, I think I was started more of like nonfiction and still loved romance. Always loved romance. That's what I write romance. But I liked nonfiction more as I grew older. My taste kind of varied. I read a little Stephen King, probably John Saul. I don't know if anyone remembers him, but he was kind of like the Stephen King horror genre. I read a lot of him. So yeah, my tastes have really kind of gone all over the map as I've grown up.
As I was reading the Great American Read series launch, one thing that stood out to me was that there were a lot of celebrities who credited certain books with getting them through a difficult time.
in their lives. Are there any books that you can point to in your life that serve that purpose for you?
One of my favorite books is actually Stephen King's book on writing. He was such an unusual person, and he also grew up reading and writing, and I'm sure you know he's a little peculiar anyways, but he had his own newspaper as a teenager, and just that passion that he had was so inspiring to me, and to this day, that's still one of my favorite books. But there's other things like Jodi Picoult. I really like some of her books. The Pact is one of my favorites that really stuck with me. It's about a teenage girl who went through something really traumatic as a kid, and it stuck with her, and she decided to commit suicide and wanted her boyfriend to do the same. And at the very end, he backs out, but it's just, I don't know, there's just details in there, and that something that sticks with you all through your life that you just can't escape really stuck with me. So there's several books that have stuck with me over the years.
I think I've done this as well, but I know a lot of people who there are also certain books that they'll revisit at various points in their lives.
Yes.
And look at how differently they see it based on their age or experiences that they've had. Are there any books like that for you?
Grapes of Wrath. I try to read that book every few years to see as I mature. I'm in my 40s now, and reading it as a teenager is so different. You know, you're pretty naive then. You're pretty self-centered. And then as you become a parent, you see things differently through the eyes of those characters. And then as you grow up, and my son's 20 now, and getting towards that empty nest period and things, you look at things differently and the struggles that it's such a human story. And it's just one of my favorites. I try to reread that every few years.
I read a book recently that had a huge impact on me. It wasn't a fictional novel. It's a book called The Organized Mind. And I've referenced it in this podcast before because it was just one of those things that changed how I view myself, how my mind works. It's written by Daniel Levitan, who is a famous neuroscientist who I also found out used to be, you know, audio recording engineer. Mm-hmm. But he talks in one of his chapters about how people who read often in studies show an increased capacity for empathy. Mm-hmm. I would be interested to hear your thoughts on that, on why that would be.
To be a good writer, you have to really study people. Something that I take very seriously when I write is dialogue. If you sit around in restaurants and listen to people talking, or maybe that husband and wife that is sitting next to you and they don't exchange one word through the whole dinner, you wonder about people, you wonder about people's lives, and then your imagination goes wild. Something I've always struggled with, actually, is that I'm extremely sensitive and empathetic. And I don't know if that's come through my reading. I think I'm a very observant person. And I pay attention to people and how they react to certain situations or words that are said to them. I've always kind of been that way. And I think that's really helped me as a writer, is to understand that human condition. And I've been through a lot of traumatic things in my life, too. So just taking those experiences and then what other people have gone through, it's so helpful as a writer and as a good human being to pay attention to other people.
Observers tend to be the introverted, quiet type.
Oh, I am.
Quiet observers often tend to be maybe overlooked. Is that something that you've noticed and struggled with at all?
I think people that get more active in the social aspects of culture and things like that, it's just a personality thing, and that's fine. But I totally agree with you about the quiet observers. We're probably more intuitive. People listen to louder people sometimes. And I think that's why writing is so important, is because quiet observers still have a lot to say. And I am one of those people. I'm not a big fan of loud people. And I think there are inspiring people out there, but they're also probably observant in certain ways. There's a difference between being intuitive and being obnoxious. I think we can listen more through the quiet observers through writing. And I wish that the school system would really push more writing and college would push more writing, because I think a lot of people aren't being heard that have very important things to say.
So you're living in a small town, which is actually here in Colorado, correct?
Yes, you grew up in Craig, Northwest Colorado.
You are delving into reading primarily as a form of entertainment.
Yes.
Initially. At what point did you think, I'd like to step to the other side and go from being the reader to actually creating my own works?
That's about 8 or 9. My dad wasn't really involved in parenting. So he worked a lot, and to get any kind of attention was big for us growing up, you know. So I remember I wrote a story. I don't even remember what it was about, but I asked him if I could read it to him. And he said, sure. So I climbed up in his lap, and he was so blown away that I had come up with something so creative and entertaining that really kind of like, oh, well, that's kind of cool. It made, you know, my dad's paying attention. And it really started from that point. I'm like, oh, maybe I can entertain people this way, because I had already read so much, but I was still so young. 8 or 9 is when I think that was. You know, I wrote letters to Santa, but I would go to my dad's office and type them. I was fascinated with typewriters. And
are you still a typewriter person, or have you switched?
It's been a long time. I have a Mac. So it took me a long time. My first novel I wrote on legal pads, longhand. And it took me a long time to come around just to want to type it on a computer. I was always so scared it would disappear at some point. I didn't trust technology.
That is true.
And I'm still a person who writes in a paper calendar, things like that. But yeah, it was just that thing about being able to entertain someone. And then we would write in class, and teachers would have me share mine. And I remember, I think it was around middle school, I had had this teacher I just loved so much. He was my English teacher. And I remember sitting in a parent-teacher conference with my mom, and he had told her, you would be wise to nurture this writing bug she has, because she's good and you can tell she's passionate about it. And that just sparked even more fire. And then in high school, I worked on my school newspaper, the school magazine, and I just kept writing always. I was published a few times. I had a couple of poems published in anthologies that I had entered in contests. And
As a teenager,
yeah. And then, you know, I was a young mom. I was 22, and life happened. So I stopped writing for quite a while, probably 8 or 10 years.
Did you focus, I think you're a CMU grad, correct?
I am.
Yeah. So did you focus your studies, obviously, on creative writing, or...?
I didn't start CMU until I was 33. I was an older student. Great. I studied multimedia journalism, and I minored in creative writing. But I had taken other courses, like long-distance courses, you know, the little mail-in courses that you can do on creative writing. I did those. But after I wrote my first novel, it's funny to go back and look at that after you've had a college education and say, wow, that was really bad. I don't know why I even thought I could get that published. It was so bad. But you're older, wiser, and there's the few out there that could maybe write a book and get published without that education, but they're few and far between.
So as you're focusing your studies on the art of writing, are you thinking to yourself that you want to hit it big someday? That you want to...
I think everyone hopes that. But I'm also realistic, and it's really interesting because I publish on Amazon, and there's just a lot of bad stuff out there. In my genre, especially romance, you get these people who hit it big, like Twilight or the 50 Shades of Grey, and everyone wants to ride on those coattails. So everyone right now is doing a series. And I'm a person that will move in the opposite direction because I believe in originality. So it's kind of sad, and it's frustrating as a person who really believes in the craft of writing. Everyone just wants to make it big and they want to make a dollar, but you're lost in this sea of bad writers. There's some good, and it costs so much money to market. There are passionate people out there that are bad writers, but they're passionate enough to keep moving forward, and I commend that on a level. But it's also frustrating for someone who's worked their whole life to get to that point. I don't know, it's just a really interesting market right now.
I know in your first book, focused on a near fatal accident where your son was very badly injured.
Yes.
And I assume many medical bills followed that process.
Yes.
Is it difficult? I mean, how do you financially, how are you able to do what you love? Because I think this mm-hmm. is something that almost every artist struggles with.
Yes.
To be able to have the time and energy to put toward your writing, mm-hmm. but still get the bills paid.
I think most writers have a day job. I do. I own a cleaning business. I had started a cleaning business when my son was young because I was tired of someone else raising him and only spending a couple hours with him a night. And I was also making minimum wage without, a college education. So I figured I'd start my own business. I started that when I lived in Maine for a year. And when we moved back to Grand Junction, I started it back up. I had a job, and that didn't last. I was more interested in spending time as a mom. And so when I started that, it was so nice just to have that flexibility. You don't have work stress to cloud your creativity, which is so nice. And then after school, I had a job for a little bit, but I had been on my own for so long as a business owner that I found that the stress was once again clouding my creativity. It was also taking away from my family time, which is very important to me. And so I'm still, even though I'm college educated, I still have my cleaning business because I have that flexibility to write. And I think a lot of writers have day jobs, so they write at night, they write late at night sometimes. I'm lucky in that I had done that for myself because I knew that's what my soul needed. I had gone a long period of time without writing, and I just felt not like myself. So when I did start up again, I don't know, I felt this whole new purpose. I was still able to pay my bills and do it on a part-time basis because I was making a lot more money working part-time. And then I could write pretty much when my son was in school or whatever. I was able to get my college education by being a business owner. So, yeah, to this day, I don't think I'd ever sit behind a desk again just because that would take away from something I love, my family and my writing.
So your first book was a personal memoir. Why did you choose for your first book to do something so intimate and personal?
Because it was a huge part of my life. It had been, a 6-year struggle of a lot of different things. And even the book's not even that long, as some memoirs are, When you tell people you've written a memoir, they're like, "You're so young. What do you have to talk about?" I'm like, "Well, let me tell you." So my son was in a car accident when he was 8. My husband was driving. They hit a deer, and they rolled down an embankment. My son was airlifted to Grand Junction. This happened outside of Meeker, and he had a severe traumatic brain injury. And then he was at St. Mary's for 4 weeks, and then we had to take him to Denver Children's Hospital. He was transferred up there for 5 more weeks. So we dealt, our life had completely been turned upside down. It was a hard thing for my husband to cope with. And then we have a kid in the hospital who's fighting for his life. And I wanted to write about something that was, there's so much out there, like celebrity-wise and stuff, and people, I don't understand that attraction. You know, you grow up rich, you don't really fight for anything. And here I am just fighting for some sense of normalcy in my life again. My son was born a certain way, and he was in an accident in his life, and then he was a completely different kid. So to deal with what we had gone through as a family, I think I really had to talk about it and to show people that no matter what goes on, you can make it through. If you love each other, you can make it through. And it wasn't just that. My dad had a massive stroke and a brain injury 6 months later. So I was taking care of him and my son, who was still in a wheelchair. And then I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis the year after that. And I had just started school. I had just started college. And then the year after that, my son had a major leg surgery that put him out of commission for quite a while. And I was still in college trying to get through school. We had to take him up to Denver once a week for appointments. And then my mom passed away the year after that. My husband's dad passed away the year after that. It just kept coming, and I didn't know how we were going to survive. But we did, because we loved each other and we are grateful we could still be together, because that was almost taken away from us. So I thought that was such an important story to tell people. And my husband was really hesitant on me releasing that. It was, you know, it's such an intimate portrait of what we had gone through, you know, and I didn't hold punches. I talked about the troubles my son and husband had trying to get over the accident, the troubles my husband and I had. I just wanted people to know that you can survive so much and be okay and have just this better outlook on life, period. I try to look at everything in a positive way after that. I mean, it just shook up our lives. So it was really important for me, and my husband understood that people needed to know there's hope in a world where it doesn't feel like there's much hope. I feel like I had to say that there is. So, and he understood that, and I released it, and he was okay with that. It was hard. It was like being naked on a Jumbotron at the Super Bowl. You're exposing everything that you had gone through, everything about your marriage and being a mom and everything. So it was interesting that I was exhausted when I was done, emotionally exhausted.
And it's interesting that you mention optimism, because I think sometimes we tend to look at artists or creative types and think, you know, they're always kind of seeing the dark side of things. Mm-hmm. But for you, having experienced that actually brought you into the light, it sounds like.
You're right. Many artists suffer from anxiety and depression, and I'm one of them. It's just, we release through our art. You know, there's artists of all types, tattoo artists and painters and writers and singers and things like that. And we all kind of release pain through art. But I think I had gone through something, and you still find this a lot with artists. Most of them have gone through something traumatic. You know, it's their muse. So I was really no different in that aspect, but I had gone through so much, and I was just so grateful that I still had my kid. You know, being a mom was everything to me. And my husband, he's just amazing. And I was so inspired by both of them, how they had gotten through that. Yeah, it did bring me into the light. And I try not to feel sorry for myself or anything like that, because I think there's enough of that out there. But
you're older now. You've released three books.
Yes.
Do you still hold on to that dream that someday you're going to hit it big? Or are you more focused on writing as a passion and as a way to exercise those things within yourself?
I think I'll always write. no matter how old I am. Of course, it'd be ideal to quit my day job and write full-time, but we're a two-income household, we have to be. You've heard from our experience, you know, medical bills bankrupted us. And so we're still kind of clawing our way back from 11 years ago. So yeah, we're a two-income household. And even if you do sell a book, that money won't last forever. and people change their interests all the time. And who knows what's going to come after Amazon or things like that. I'm just so grateful to people like Amazon who give artists this platform, YouTube for singers and things like that. It's just a different climate than it ever used to be, and there's so many opportunities for people. But like I had mentioned earlier, you're kind of lost in a sea of other people. And that's really why I got my education. I needed to know how to stand out. I have a website. I learned how to do that in school. So studying journalism really helped me with that. How to use social media, things like that, but I'm still shy. It's weird talking about myself so much. I try to be humble, but you can't really be humble when you're trying to get your name out there. So it's a really hard thing for me to balance, trying to remain humble and still be able to promote myself shamelessly.
As you're getting started out as a writer, and obviously you've written various things for years, since your teenage years, you, as a writer, every writer has to find their voice. Did you find that there were any writers that you felt more influenced by in terms of finding that within yourself?
I'm a very sensitive, empathetic person. So I tend to veer more to writers who really write from the heart without being cheesy, you know. So my books have a humor. Humor is very important to me too. So I make sure there's some humor in there and some sexiness. But to know that these people are human going through their own struggles. Both of my romances talk about someone who has an illness. My new book, The Dandelion Hunter, talks about a girl with mental illness. She has, you know, depression. The one before that, she was in a car accident and was in a wheelchair, but she grew up in a spoiled, rotten household. And so trying to find a way to get around that and fight for her health and things like that. So I think most of my books will cover some sort of health topic, you know, real people with real life problems. There's so much erotic fluff out there in the romance industry. I really try to veer away from that. And I follow a lot of authors that are trying to do the same thing as me on Instagram. And they do the stock covers and things like that. And I'm different, but I don't know how to market myself as different. So I'm learning as I go.
Yeah, that's the flip side of social media and the technology that allows so many more people to put themselves out there. Mm-hmm. Is how do you stand out?
Right, very much so. But I want to stay true to who I am. My first book cover, I drew the picture of my family on there, and then I had a friend who's a graphic artist, Michael Green. He did the graphics for me. My second book, I commissioned a friend's daughter who's an artist, and then I just put my own kind of filters on it. The third one is also my friend Michael's work, but I think it's important to help others out who are struggling just as much as you, and especially use your local artists who want to be noticed as well. I think that's so important to give a leg up to other people who are trying to realize their dreams. So,
do you find that you have found through social media or any other means a supportive writing community?
Kind of. Facebook's different for me. I used to have an author page, and I wasn't really staying on top of it more than anything. Instagram's pretty good. You know, you can use hashtags and everything, and then you'll find other writers, and you follow each other and see each other's journeys, and it's nice to get excited for someone else because they're so passionate, and I think Instagram has a great community for that kind of thing. I haven't found that on Facebook. No, I went off Facebook for a while just because of the political climate we're in. I think a lot of people are dealing with that. And I liked Instagram as you saw more of the happy in people. And I really liked that. And that's a good place to market your stuff when people are don't really have that kind of agenda. It's more of like, look what I can do. You know, buy my product, I'll buy yours. Let's support each other. So yeah, I really like Instagram for that.
Do you have a supportive in-person community? Do you have friends who are writers?
I don't, but I have supportive friends that love my books and said, please don't lie to me if you don't like it. So I have friends as my beta readers when I'm finished with a book. My husband loves my romances, actually, and he likes to read them first. He's always the first person to buy my book. I think that's really important in a marriage, is to have someone who's so supportive of you, and he really has been my best cheerleader. I have great friends who support that and will put things on their own Facebook pages. Word of mouth is so important. Asking for that kind of stuff, and that's hard for me as an introvert to ask for that. Will you please promote this on your page and have your friends do it as well?
I feel your pain.
It's an interesting thing. I'm not a person who likes to ask for help or favors or anything like that. So no, I probably won't be very successful. I'm trying. I'm learning. I think everyone wants to make money from a profession that they love. But I back up my work. And that's interesting about being an independent author, is you get that freedom without having to deal with a publisher or editors or anything like that. You can stay true to what you've done. And maybe that's a good thing, maybe that's a bad thing. I'm on a mission, you know, to write my own stuff. And that's going to be hard for me, I think, to make money that way. I don't really make money on my books because, first of all, I don't market very well, and I just love it so much, and it's such a pride thing for me because I had wanted it for so long. And to see your book on a shelf in a bookstore or something, it's so exciting, but you're not really expecting it. When I first started, I'm like, oh, this is a cool story. People are going to love it, and it's going to sell so well, and it didn't. And it's kind of an ego buster at first. And I think I go through this every time I publish a book. Go through like a month-long depression because no one's buying it. My husband bought it and that's it. Or friends are buying it and that's it. And then I look at what I've done. You know, I'm following my dream. And not everyone can say that. So I'm proud of myself for that. So I really go back and forth. Do I really expect to make money from this? Or can I just be proud of myself for doing this and getting it out there and following my dream? It's something I've always wanted. And it's something that I can show my son. You know, go out, he has a disability, so it's really important to show him, no matter what you want in life, just go after it, no matter what anyone says. And of course I have people in my life who, like, what are you doing? You really think you're gonna be famous? No, but I've done it. Have you published any books? So yeah, it's interesting. Of course you want to make money from it, but it's still very satisfying to see your book on a shelf or to know that you've done it.
So. I think there's something to be said for that creative freedom. You can write on your own timeline.
Right.
As you are inspired.
Mm-hmm. My son teases me all the time. He's like, shouldn't you be writing? I said, it doesn't work like that. I'm not writing a school paper. You know, I have to really tap into my characters and what's going on. And I'm glad that I have a job where I don't really have to interact with people, because I have dialogue going on in my head all day long. And I have a phone near me. It was like, oh, that was nice. You know, so I do notes or whatever on my phone. And a lot of writers actually say this too. It doesn't matter what you write as long as you're writing, but I don't write like that. I don't know if other writers are always, they treat it like a job where you show up every day and you do your writing, and I admire that, but I'm not that kind of writer. I have to really be inspired, and there's always just so much chaos going on. It would be nice to have my own office. That would be really nice. You know, I have two dogs and a son and a husband who are constantly interrupting me. So yeah, it would be nice to have that I don't know if I could even sit in an office and be inspired that way. It kind of has to come to me. And then I tell everyone, leave me alone. I'm really inspired right now. I need to write. And then I'll write for 8 hours straight.
And that's a good point, because the creative process is something that's individual.
It is.
There are probably no two writers, artists, musicians who approach things exactly the same way. It has to work for however their brain works. They process things.
Right.
So that's something you have to find in yourself. I mean, did you come to that? Was there a time in your life when you approached it differently, where you would force yourself to sit down and, okay, I'm going to write now?
When I wrote my first book, I did it on my lunch hour on legal pads in the break room. And so I guess it was a good thing, because I dedicated that time specifically to writing and stuff. But I still found myself sometimes, like, you know, crickets or whatever in the background, because nothing was coming to me. And I think writers should do that, is to show up and write as much as they can, even if it's a couple of sentences. I write kind of odd sometimes. I'll write scenes that are maybe 4 chapters ahead of time. But, you know, if I hear a conversation going on in my head between characters, or I think of something, I make sure that's written down. So it's not just writing from chapter 1 to chapter 15. I'm kind of all over the place, because I'm always thinking of different things. And then I can go back and change something if I need to. But every writer is different, I imagine. So I think self-publishing is a nice safety net for people to say, I can publish whatever I want. But I think a lot of people look down on that. But I think that climate is changing too. You have YouTube stars being discovered all the time. If it's out there, someone might be reading it. I run promotions every few months to give my books away for free on Kindle. It doesn't matter that I'm not making money to me. I just know that it's in someone's hands. When I released Please Excuse the Mess, the first time I did a free promotion, I had 1,300 downloads. It's like, wow, that would have been nice if that was $1.50 in my pocket for each book. But then it's on 1,300 Kindles, and that's all I really cared about in the end. People really did look down on self-publishing for a long time. But there's a lot of work that comes along with self-publishing. As we had talked about, you have to advertise yourself and put yourself out there and schedule your own events and things like that. But even now, with the rise of self-publishing, the big 5 publishing houses are requiring more from the author, you know, to do more marketing on your own. They just don't have the money for it, because that's changing. And it doesn't mean I won't revisit it somewhere on down the line to talk to an agent, a literary agent, and try to get a publisher. I think that would be a dream come true. But right now, I like the freedom that I have, that no one's going to touch my thoughts, my work.
So we've talked a lot about marketing. Mm-hmm. For people who have been listening to this podcast and want to support you and find out more about you and how to get your books, how can they do that?
Amazon is great in that they have an extended distribution. So you can buy it on barnesandnoble.com. There's a lot of different places where you can buy my book. If you just Google my name, there'll be places that will come up to buy it. Of course, Amazon is where I publish it. I try to keep it in bookstores. And on my website, I also have excerpts from my books that people can read and hopefully buy eventually. But it talks a lot about my life personally. So, and I think that's important, to market yourself as a person. Not just your work, but your person. And that's why I have an open Instagram where anyone can follow me or whatever. And I share a lot of family stuff. My dogs are on there. I want them to see me as a person who has a dream and who is trying to accomplish that dream. I think that's so important for marketing anything. So I have an Instagram page. I no longer have a Facebook page. My website is heatherportner.com. You can get my book straight from Amazon, barnesandnoble.com. There's a few different ways you can get my books.
That sounds like a great way to conclude today's podcast. Heather, I wish you continuing success in your work and offer my sincerest appreciation for your willingness to share intimate details of your life as a passionate reader and writer. Hopefully, we've inspired our audience to explore some or all of the books on the Great American Read List, to pick up copies of your books, and perhaps to jumpstart their own writing careers. To access that list of 100 best-loved novels, visit pbs.org/The Great American Read. You'll also find the schedule of upcoming theme episodes, including the date for the finale reveal. Find out the many ways you can cast your vote and ensure your voice is part of the debate. Remember to follow Crossing the Divide on Facebook to keep apprised of new releases and other events highlighting issues impacting life on Colorado's Western Slope. This Crossing the Divide podcast was recorded at Mesa County Library's 970 West Studio.